Hey, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the How to Become an Elite Financial Advisor podcast. I wanted to extend a personal invitation. If you had questions about coming to our How to Charge Live event in April of 2025, that you would go to howtocharge.live.com. That's howtocharge.live.com. Click on a button there that says schedule the call. And I'd love to answer any questions you have about coming to our event in April. It will sell out, but if you have questions, I want to answer them as quickly as possible so you can get your seat to that event. I look forward to seeing you here with us in April. And now, enjoy today's episode.
Aaron, thank you so much for being here. Our audience loves that we get practical really quick. I think there's so many big things we can talk about, but your story is an outlier within outliers of your success. And so I know there's a lot of people that want to get in your head, and you've created a bunch of content for that, which we'll talk about later. But before we dive in, if you kind of give just a high level, your journey, did you know you wanted to be an advisor and kind of what that was like for you?
No, actually, the short story was I was one of six kids. My dad died when I was 11, left my mom with six kids and no money. So we went from a middle-class lifestyle to poverty overnight. So I've worked, I bought everything I've ever owned since I was 11 years old. I had to start working at 11. When I was 16, I was involved in a very bad car accident with a motorcyclist. He actually hit me. And as a result, he died, but there was no witnesses. So I ended up being charged with involuntary manslaughter, went through a criminal trial, and I was found absolutely not guilty. And then the parents of the young man sued my mother and me for a ridiculous amount of money. But think about the lessons that I was learning along the way. One, my dad died leaving no money or no life insurance. Man, that would have been a really nice thing to have had. And two, going through a civil trial, a criminal trial, a civil trial, I remember my mother saying, because of you, we may have to pitch a tent on the high school football field, because she thought we were going to lose the only asset that we had, which was our family home. So, I've gleaned a lot of lessons from the terror that was that experience. Wow. Fortunately, my husband noticed me in high school. We started dating in high school, and he became an Air Force pilot. And the funny thing is, the bride is supposed to pay for the wedding. And of course, my mother had no money to pay for a wedding. So I literally found out that Wheel of Fortune was doing tryouts for Brides Week. So I went up and I got on the Wheel of Fortune and I solved the final puzzle and won the big payout. And believe it or not, the puzzle I solved was called Down in the Dumps, which at that point in my life, I'd had nothing but, tragedy and loss, right? But I married my high school sweetheart and, by the time we were 22, we took the winnings from Wheel of Fortune and some savings, and we gave $19,000 to a stockbroker. That was all of our money, and he lost it for us in about 6 months.
Oh my goodness.
So I always tell people I had a PhD in the School of Hard Knocks by the time I was 22, but, I count it all good because, it led me to where my profession. And so Bob and I got married as a fighter pilot. We moved 17 times in the first 14 years we were married. And the last, his last duty station was in Panama City, Florida. So I went into a stock brokerage firm looking for a job as a secretary. And the man said, I'm going to make you a stockbroker. And I was like, what's that? I didn't know the difference between a stock and a bond. I'd never heard of a mutual fund, but I was young in my middle 20s. And I was like, okay, So that began the journey. The first 10 or 11 years were just a nightmare of great proportions. Imagine me coming from living literally in the projects growing up to then trying to act like I knew about money and finance. Wow. For a long time, not only was I not believable to the clients, but I wasn't believable to myself, right? So that in a nutshell, got me to where at least the beginning of the professional journey.
Goodness. I felt that in my body as you walked me through that. I think my story also has some stuff to where I'll reference it for motivation's sake, but like, it's almost so heavy at times. You're like, I don't want to give you more, cause right. Thinking back to the moments you were in those places, I'm sure it was just heavy, lonely.
Oh yeah. Don't even get me started. We don't want to go there. Let's talk about good things.
We'll talk about that later. But is there a clip of the Wheel of Fortune floating around out there?
What's really funny is, I've written two books and I've done a lot of TV and a lot of stuff. And one of the magazines that was doing an article on me said, you know, we can't believe this Wheel of Fortune story. So we want it. Is there a clip? And it turns out, now I'm ancient as the ancient of days. And back in the day, there really wasn't any, there was no VCRs. No. So I only saw it once. I saw it when it was live or recorded. So I went back to whatever, ABC, NBC television. And no kidding, they said they lost. There was like a 2-month period in that particular year that was lost. So the magazine publisher made me, actually, I had to get notarized affidavits from like 10 people, friends of mine who, who verified that, yes, in fact, I was on the show. But I really regret that. I was like, oh, yeah, really? Those 2 months? I mean, seriously? But, you know, there's no clip of it, which makes me so sad.
Yeah, man. Well, with your story, it makes me think of some things people have told me before, that I do believe that difficult situations build resilience. And as I look back at some of my stories, I'm like, but I think it can go so far that it breaks you. Like, I think there's people where it was like so tumultuous that not everybody that's been through hard things does come out driven, successful, the way I hear you talk about it, kind of optimistic, you know, thankful. As you've coached advisors, because there's some advisors, and I pray that people don't have to go through that stuff. Do people need some of that to be successful, or is the stuff you teach and even the stuff I teach, like, do you believe it is possible, regardless of your story, to implement it and get that level of success? How would you unpack that?
First of all, I've actually read some books or stories about how people who have a young age, let's say before the age that you can legally drink, if you go through a lot of tragedy, hard times, it does build resilience, because you don't have drugs or alcohol to cover the pain and, you know, dull the pain. So you have to go through it without any help, right? You know what I'm saying? And in my case, we couldn't afford psychologists. The interesting thing is my dad had a PhD in psychology, but we couldn't afford a psychologist when I needed it the most. And that's all okay, right? So I do think, you know, I do have a lot of advisors. I've trained 1,600 advisors in the last couple of years. And they too, like, I don't have a story like yours. And I'm like, you don't have to have a story like mine. And so, but I do think you have to be able to relate to people where they are, because you and I both know it's all in the relating that the magic happens, right? And so, but I don't think any one advisor, any person has to go through what you went through or what I went through in order to be successful. Absolutely, because I've seen it play out. You don't have to have that kind of tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that now. I do believe, and I think there's at times a frustration I feel is, part of our coaching started because people started reaching out to me when they said, hey, Sten, you're doing some cool stuff at a young age. Will you tell me what it is? And I kind of did that for free on a one-off basis until I was like, well, I don't have time to do it to the degree I'm getting questions.
Sure.
So I want to turn this into a system. I want to teach. I found out, actually, I really enjoy hanging out with other advisors and learning things. But there is this point where you meet people and you tell them the thing and then they don't do it. And I'm like, all I want is like the person, like, if you do what we say, it works. You know, I'm not making this stuff up. In your journey as an advisor, and then as have been speaking a lot, writing books, where have you landed with that? Have you said, I have less tolerance now? Like, if you're not going to do it, I can't help you. Or do you think the resistance to action is just part of the coaching process?
Well, here's the thing. I do think that advisors think that there's a magic pill. And if they do this for, you know, it's kind of like the whole gym mentality. They sign up in January, go to the gym, and by February, you know, 95% of them don't go anymore, right? And so I do think, and I'll back up and say, one of the things that I think is most important, and one of the things I think is really missing in our industry, is in the place that I started my coaching program is, I shouldn't call it a coaching, mine's pure training. Mm-hmm. And that is, what is your why? Right. And I really think that advisors need to get with their significant others, their spouses or their partners, whoever it is, and really write down, what do they want to have happen? I always want them to visualize, what do you want to have happen on the last day you're in business? And I'm here to tell you, on the last day that you're in business, if your business depends on you to meet with every single client, it will have very little value in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Now, coming from that point, And the case in point is the day I sold my company, I sold it in October 2017. The buyer of my firm bought another woman's business, and she had about the same amount of AUM as I did, but she had two big things going against her. She had the same amount of employees. She just hadn't empowered them. So all of her clients were used to and expected to meet with her. And unfortunately, she'd had a massive stroke and she had to sell. So she ended up getting, think about this, 25 cents on the dollar compared to me. And I asked advisors, I said, you know, would you go home to your spouse and say, look at me, I'm so proud of that result? Of course not, right? So I always say, let's begin with the end in mind. What do you want to have happen on that last day? Do you want to get a really big check like I did? Mm-hmm. Or do you want to get something else? Do you want to, you know, pass it off to your son or daughter, whatever it is? And then to me, once you get clear on what you want, especially and have your spouse or your partner buy into that dream, then the steps to get there become very easy.
Yeah.
But I really don't think, and I think, Stan, a problem in our industry is that it's really not that hard for an advisor to get to a level of personal comfort. I mean, they can make whatever it is, $200,000 or $300,000. They have a house, two cars, they can put their kids through college. So their why has to be big enough to propel them to do the things necessary to become multi-million dollar producers. And so I try and give them a visual. I tell them my why, like, you know, my husband and I both came from poor families. And so we set goals that every 5 years we wanted to take all members of our family on a trip of some kind. So since 2000, you know, every 5 years we've taken between 60, 77 people on a cruise. We found cruising is easiest.
Yeah.
We now support 5,500 orphans in Africa because of the success of our business. You know, we've paid for alternative cancer treatments for two of our family members costing $500,000 because they couldn't tolerate traditional chemotherapy and radiation. So, you know, putting a why behind making money is so powerful, and it will be the motivation. It will be the fuel that makes you do what it is you want to, that you want to do. Because sometimes, Sen, we won't do it for ourselves, but we'll do it for somebody else, or we'll do it for a cause that we care about. So I think really getting into the why, if you can do that, and then if you can get a partner to believe in that and say, and we have them write out, what is your why? I want to do this. And I give them mine and said, your why is not going to be mine is, but what is your why? And get buy-in from your significant other, because then the spouse doesn't mind if you have to go in on a Saturday to pick up a check, or you have to stay late to do a seminar, because you're both working in the same, you know, in the same direction. And I think that is a huge benefit if you can get there.
Yeah. I think there's a layer of accountability. It's one of the stats that kind of rocked my world when, I don't know if it was a Harvard study or a recent employment study where it said, I think your chances of achieving a goal are like 60% if you make a goal and kind of put it out in the universe. But it's like 95% if you tell somebody about it and you give them the authority to hold you accountable.
Totally.
And if like, okay, if that's even true to the smallest degree, like, shouldn't that be almost like the secret to success is like, get awareness to some degree, which is trainings. I think you then get stuck on the belief, which is like, if you need accountability or coaching from somebody else.
Yeah.
But it also made me think of the book, The War of Art, mm-hmm. where the idea of resistance is that if you're listening to this podcast right now, you know, we could look at Erin's story and be like, wow, like, I haven't gone through what she's gone through. Good for her. I don't think I can do what she did. But I bet that there was a lot of resistance in your story too. And part of it is like, right now we're all waking up, and I think resistance hits us as we get out of bed, whether it's going to the gym, whether it's making that extra call, whether it's the seminar. That when I read that book and it normalized that, like, just because I don't have what I want right now doesn't mean there's something wrong with me, but there is something broken in my system that's not allowing me to do the things I need to do to get there. Mm-hmm. So as you built your training, what are you focusing on? What have you learned about advisors that you're saying, I can't do it for you? At the end of the day, you have to be engaged and resilient. What parts of that are you trying to reduce the resistance for advisors?
Well, I'll back up and tell you a little bit more of the story. So I struggled for the first 10 or 11 years in the business, to the point, Stan, that I went to my branch manager, said, I'm done, I'm quitting, I just want to go get a job. I mean, I was taking clients that brought me $50,000, $5,000, $100,000. I mean, it was just ridiculous. But, you know, God love it, I was doing the best I could. I just didn't know how to do anything different, right? So he said, go get some business coaching. So I did. And I enrolled in a program. I thought, I'm going to embrace this wholeheartedly. And on the in the third year, the 12th session, we were all asked to stand up and share the results that we'd gotten over the 3 years with somebody else in class. And so, by the way, in my class, there were doctors, lawyers, plumbers. I mean, it wasn't all financial advisors. And so I happened to find this random guy and I said, do you want to do the exercise together? He goes, yeah, let's do it. And his name was Paul. And I said, I wanted to go first because, like, hey, you know, I was excited about my progress. I said, I'm Aaron Botsford. I'm from Dallas, Texas. 3 years ago, I was doing around $300,000 in production. I said, this year, I'm on target to do somewhere between 400 and 450. And I was thinking to myself, like, look at me, you know, I was very happy with my progress. And so then it was his turn. And he happened to be a financial advisor as well from Virginia. And he said 3 years ago, he was doing 300,000 as well. And I thought, well, look at that. We are just alike. And I was so happy. And then he said, this year I'm on target to do 3 million in production. And he said, I don't meet with any of my existing clients anymore. In the last 3 years, I've built an entire team around me. So all I do is go out and sell the philosophy of my firm. And everybody has to understand, nobody gets me. They have to agree to work with various members of my team. And of course, his voice starts trailing off in my head. I'm like, what did you just say? You went from 300,000 to 3 million 3 years. He goes, yep. And like, you don't meet with all your clients for their reviews? No, I have a team to do that. And he was younger than you, Stan. He was like 29 years old. I was like, oh my God, like, how did he do that? So I started stammering and stumbling. I'm like, could I just buy a few hours of your time? And he was so gracious. He said, why don't you come spend the day with me and my team? And of course, as quickly as I could get back to Texas, I made sure that my husband, who was an airline pilot at that time, I wanted him to come with me because I just knew there was going to be a big cost to getting results like that. Like, maybe I was going to have to divorce my husband or, you know, sell my firstborn child. And I just wanted my husband to understand, like, the costs. And, you know, but it wasn't like that at all. And so really and truly, Stan, you know, we spent most of the day, of course, I wanted a to-do list. And we really talked about the mindset of a business owner. You know, he told me to read that book, The E-Myth Revisited, which I read cover to cover on my way home from DC, and really get into the idea of this. And so you asked me, like, what do I train on? Well, first we talk about what is it that you're building? And we go immediately from when somebody says, what do you do for a living? You never say, I'm a financial advisor, which is what 90% of advisors say. You say, I own a financial services company. I own a financial services business. And I liken it to, like, one of my girlfriends in Texas. She owns the largest plumbing company in all of Texas called Benjamin Franklin Plumbing. And I always tell my advisors, do you think for a moment that my friend Carissa Richardson has ever gotten on her hands and knees and repaired a toilet? Because most businesses hire other people to do the actual work of the business. And I can't for the life of me figure out, like, why that message never made it to our industry. And so what we effectively do is we get out of college or we leave another job. And what we do is we buy ourselves a job. We don't really have a business because it depends on us showing up every single day. And so we really get real clarity around what it is that we own, what are we doing? Okay. And so that's the first part that we start. And the second part, believe it or not, is, you know, a lot of advisors will say, hey, Aaron, I heard you used to work with 10, 20, 30, $100 million clients. And I'm like, yeah. And they say, well, can you help me find those people? And I'm like, of course I can. That's where I played. And I'll say, but let's say I put you in a room full of $30 million prospects. Would you have any idea what to say to them to either get the first meeting or to close them? And they're usually, no, I'm not 100% sure. So the first place we start, Stan, is how to close a prospect of any size the first time you meet with them. No more of these 1, 2, 3, 4 discovery meetings. And like you, and I know we're going to talk about, I charge a financial planning fee upfront, separate and apart from AUM. And I was willing to spend an hour to an hour and a half with anybody. Yep. But if they didn't write me a check at that first meeting, it was highly likely we were never going to see each other again, because I also had a policy where I didn't chase prospects. And I love that. I always advise clients, if you create that policy, then you have to get really good at what you do in that first meeting. And what was nice about having that policy is if that client, for whatever reason, that prospect didn't say yes to me, then that gave me the opportunity to diagnose exactly what happened everything in my business was fine tuned in from how the clients were greeted, how they were seated, what happened next, the words I said this, what they were presented, everything. And so if I didn't get yes, that something had to be diagnosed. And typically, and I'll just, this is like free advice, this is the best advice you'll ever get, is that if they didn't say yes to you, then what I did not do was I did not leave them with a clear understanding of the consequences of not doing the planning that we're recommending. And we always operated, Stan, I'm not sure what you train, but I never even said the word investments. In any meeting I ever had, I closed 95% of my cases without ever mentioning the word investments. Instead, I always operated on the risk side of the balance sheet. And, you know, we talked about, and of course, it's very easy for me. I mean, look at the things that happen in my life. Like, how much life insurance do you have? How about your older sons and daughters? You know, your son has 4 kids. How much life insurance does he have? And then we would always tell stories. Okay, well, let me tell you a story about this client. Let me tell you about a story about that client. And so I was able, to me, the most efficient thing you can do is have the skill and the confidence to meet with a $40 million prospect and close them in the first meeting and have them write you a $40,000 or $50,000 check to say, yes, please help me fix these issues. So that's kind of, we start with the mindset and we immediately go, let's get really good at closing. And then once you get good at closing, that skill and the confidence it brings, you become this prospect magnet, like, because you have this aura about you, you know exactly what to say in any situation. And it's really powerful. And what was cool for me, Stan, is that I didn't know when I started this training program 6 or 8 years ago, I started writing it and stuff. I had no idea. I thought, well, it worked for me, but could it ever actually work for other people? And now I've got really great data that it can work for anybody who just follows the script, you know? So it's pretty cool.
Some of the things you said there were really big and aspirational for most people. I think there were times in my career where I would see somebody like you and your result feels so far away. Mm-hmm. Like, so I'm at the base of Everest and Aaron's at the top being like, hey, come up here. And I'm like, I don't even know where to start. I do think it's important though, to be aware of what is possible.
Right.
I know based on my story, there were times where I was like, do people even make more than $100,000 a year? Probably just like the biggest number I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
So for everybody listening, I hope you heard the first part of her story that she was like, I didn't even know if I was going to do this thing. And I'm guessing at that stage, if somebody would have said, hey, Aaron, go close this $30 million prospect or get them to agree in the first meeting to pay you $50,000 for just who you are as an advisor, would you have laughed at him at that point?
Oh, I mean, it was absurd. I really, like I said, I remember being at a conference in a hotel room with 2 girlfriends who were in the business, and they had a goal of making $250,000 a year. And I thought, I don't even know what I would do with $250,000. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't relate to it at all.
Yeah.
I mean, my goal was $50,000 in a year. And in my first year, I made $14,997, right? And, you know, after my 1 day with Paul, I mean, this is how powerful modeling is. 3 years after I met with Paul, I did $3 million and then $4 million and $5 million, and my business just kept growing. But it really is about modeling what works. And what I've tried to do is I tell my advisors, this is what works and this is what doesn't. Because I always think, I said, oh, for God's sake, does every advisor have to make all the same mistakes? Can you just not follow a formula? It's like baking a cake. If you continue, you know, you do this right measurements, you do it, you'll get the same cake every single time. Do you have to like make up the ingredients of a cake? You know, no, just get a box, you know, get a cake mix that's already done, right? And that's kind of what I try and do. Otherwise, it's so painful, you know, because this business, it involves so much rejection. And that is one of the things we talk about in my program too. And that is a lot of people, they won't take it to the next level. They won't take the risk. They won't take the risk of meeting with this $40 million prospect because the fear of rejection sometimes holds them back from taking that chance.
Yeah.
And I want to give you one other story. And that is, I can relate to people at every level in the business, from 20,000, 14,997 to multi-millions of dollars. But I did get really good at my, whatever you call it, I'm not even thinking of the word, but anyway, one time I got invited I got a referral into one of the most famous Dallas Cowboys that's ever existed on the earth. And I signed an NDA, so I can't say his name, but I remember getting this meeting. His bookkeeper said, I think they could really use your help. I'm like, really? I mean, I knew he was covered up with advisors. I mean, everybody on this call would know exactly who I'm talking about. So here I am. I'm a 25-year veteran in the business. I'm sitting out of his office and I'm shaking in my boots. Okay. So I love it that you never really arrive. Mm. Right. That was a challenge for me, not because of how much money. I mean, I walked in, I had no idea how much money he had. I didn't know how famous he was. I knew, you know, how covered up he probably was with advisors and everything like that. And so even though I was shaking in my boots, I walked in and now you're on a stage, right? And so I'm a great actress. I was on stage and 2.5 hours later, I came out with a new client. And the funniest thing was I wasn't mentally prepared for that. I just knew he'd be like, oh, thanks, little girl. We got it all taken care of. Wow. But I disturbed him and I disturbed him and I disturbed him. I did exactly what I teach.
Yep.
And at the end, his wife is actually, oh my gosh, we got to get this taken care of. And he goes, okay, Aaron, what's it going to take to get all these problems, these issues resolved or looked at? And so what he was really asking me is, what's your financial planning fee? And because I was, as a veteran, as a seasoned veteran, I was still not prepared. And so I looked at the wall and his jersey was on the wall and I just added three zeros to his jersey. I said, well, my annual financial planning fee, I'm going to say the word, will be $43,000 a year. And he's like, done. That's so reasonable, right? Mm-hmm. So now we're chit-chatting and we're talking and I'm thinking my husband's never going to believe this. And then he looked up at his jersey and he goes, oh, I get it. And we both started laughing because he knew I just pulled it out of the air, right? But it worked.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say you said like 20,000 and then based on his reaction, you'd say one monthly.
No, I probably should have though.
That's great. And I appreciate you sharing that story. Yeah. Something we talk a lot about is quantifying your value because I believe people don't solve small problems. They solve big problems. And for me, as I looked at my story, if somebody said no to me, I was like, to your point, they didn't understand the cost of inaction or the true benefit of action. And we'll tell advisors, if you solve a problem for someone in year one, the true value is not probably what it did for them in that year. It's probably more accurate to multiply that out over a 10-year period and saying, if you take action now, this is what's possible. Or if you don't, here's the cost of maybe inaction. And I found without that, you're hoping you just catch somebody on a good day when they're ready to make a choice, because most advisors, and I think the industry does a terrible job of this, is there's like this average path we all accept of just bump into as many people as possible, hope you catch them on the right day where they say yes, and if not, just move on, versus really focusing on like, we should probably all be master communicators. Like that skill should probably be on day one, say, if you want to be a great advisor, that the knowledge piece is there, but you can surround yourself with knowledgeable people. You have to learn to convey confidence and to tell a story, because I think that's where people are like, oh, I get what you're saying. And then they take action.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing, as I said, I operate on the risk side of the balance sheet. So I teach advisors now, actually today's 23 different, we call them disturbing tracks. And we just ask them things like, oh, you have a second home. It's in Park City, Utah. So how is the house titled? Is it in your, you know, is it in your personal name? Is it in some kind of a trust? You'll find 99% of the time they bought it in their personal names. And so then you talk about, okay, well, let's imagine, like, for instance, Dan, 3 weeks ago tomorrow, I was having book club. I'm at my Park City home and a lady fell in my driveway and broke her hand and her wrist because I had ice, right? Now, she's not going to sue me, but if she did sue me, what's so nice is I have my house. I have every asset I have so locked down that you sue me, you're not going to get a penny of my money. I mean, it's great. In fact, and that's what I teach, how to protect clients' assets. And so what I found, you know, and I teach advisors how to move up market and work with higher net worth prospects. One, because they're easier. They have more margin in their lives. But what high net worth people, they don't want to talk about retirement planning, investments. They want to make sure that all their risks are, you know, they don't like feeling vulnerable.
Yeah.
They don't like thinking that, you know, I'll say, so you have a 18-year-old kid driving a car at Texas A&M in your name?
Oh, wow, yeah.
So let's imagine he happens to have a couple cocktails. He's not 21 and he hits a plastic surgeon. And now you're being sued for $25 million. How does that play out with your current, you know, your current state of affairs? And what I found is interesting is like you get these high net worth people. They are totally prepared. They can handle a 10, 20, 30% decline in the market. That's just a bubble. It's a blip. But you hit a guys and you say, what's your plan? How have you protected yourself from that $25 million lawsuit? I mean, they start sweating bullets.
Wow.
And it'll be, it's typically, when I teach these disturbing tracks, there's 23 of them. You have to use, in my practice, the first one's probably not going to catch them. The second one, they're going to start getting disturbed. By the third one, she's punching him in the side saying, we got to get this stuff taken care of.
Yeah.
And so when you say adding value, I add value by demonstrating to them how I'm going to help them prevent catastrophic failure in their financial life. Because I don't think anything on the retirement side, anything on the money management side, anything aspirational, you know, because the fear of loss is 4 times or 12 times more powerful than the opportunity for gain. So that's why what's interesting is when an advisor comes in, they have their, excuse me, when a prospect comes in, they have their attorney in their head up here, their CPA here, the Mercedes dealer here, and then us. And my goal was at the end of the first meeting, I want to sweep myself up and be on par with their most highly valued current advisor. And typically, I would hear the response, how come my attorney never told me that? How come my current advisor never told me that? How come my real estate agent never told me that? And my answer was always, I don't know. But if we work together, we can get that fixed. So I always started and fixed problems on the risk side of the balance sheet because nobody wants to feel vulnerable and feel like, you know, oh, great, you got a money manager that's making you 18% a year. It's just that much more for somebody to come in and sue you and take away your lifestyle. And I've seen it happen hundreds, if not thousands of times. Yeah. I usually end up with these people after it's all the devastation has happened. They're like, what, you know, what do we do now? I'm like, well, you didn't protect your money in the first place. So let's go ahead and let's protect it now. Let's do what we need to do now. Because on the way home this afternoon, you could get in a car accident. I mean, car accidents are the most common threat to people's livelihood and to their financial future. We live in a very litigious society. So one of the things I teach is how do you protect that money from catastrophic failure?
Yeah, I love that angle. I do appreciate the science behind it. I do think the risk piece gets people's attention more than if you meet a client, and most of our ideal clients have other advisors. And if what we're trying to do is just say, we can make you a little bit more money than they are, I don't know if that's enough to disrupt their trust circle and get in their world. But as I look back at some of my biggest prospects recently, business owners, it was a conversation about what if this, and they're like, and the odds are maybe not 100% that thing happens, but if they're even 5 or 10% and no one's talked about this, I do think those are the ones that got them to act faster. So I love that.
Yeah. Like I said, it's especially as you move up market, if you're going with a business owner, they've already made their money. They don't really need you to make the money. They won't need you to protect them and protect their downside. And, you know, it took me, you know, 10 years to figure that out. But, and again, I did it intuitively. Because I think it's natural because of my background, right? I was in a car accident where there was a fatality. My family was sued, right? I understand the fear my mother had, right? And so now you magnify it. My mother was broke. I mean, and so she thought, we were going to lose our house. But now you work with people that have $50 million. They have the same exact emotional connection to not just their money, but what their money, the lifestyle their money affords them, you know?
Yeah, I love that. Well, I'd love to talk more about this. So everybody right now is taking a bunch of notes and they're rethinking all their scripts. Where can people go to learn more about your training and to dive deeper into that?
It's very kind of you to ask. And I would love to talk to you about what you do and your coaching and have you on one of my programs. And they can go to www.aaronbotsford.com. And they can always, you know, if they go to the website, we have personal strategy sessions with people from my team. I do a lot of training. They can request, I call my training called the secret sauce, and that is how to disturb them on the risk side of the balance sheet and how important that is, because it just makes it so easy. It was like taking candy from babies. I mean, there was, and again, none of this 2, 3, 4 discovery meetings. You know, I wouldn't open up my laptop if I didn't have a check for $10,000 or $20,000 to say, yeah, let's do this. You know, we weren't going any further. So, but yeah, AaronBosser.com. And thank you so much, Sten, for having me. It's been a pleasure. And again, I'd like to follow up with you. I think we could do a lot of work together and help a lot of advisors.
Yeah, we'll definitely be talking soon. Appreciate
it. Okay. Thank you.
Sten here. Hope you're doing well. I want to ask you for a favor. My legacy team is growing, and I'm looking to fill a couple positions. I'm looking for an experienced advisor, somebody that can come in right away and start serving clients to help us handle the overflow of opportunities we have. But I'm also looking for up-and-coming advisors, a pair planner, junior advisor that wants to learn with me to come help level up our team, but also allow me to help them level up and scale their business quicker over time. If you are interested in this opportunity or you know somebody that would be potentially a great fit, please email us at arome@investlegacy.com. We're happy to follow up with anybody, have a conversation with them. So if you can keep your eyes and ears open, I'd really appreciate it.